Chapter 78. There is a ritual I undertake in nearly every life. It is the assassination of Richard Lyle. Every life, since the first murder, I have either dispatched him directly or sent others to do it for me before he can begin his murdering of the women of Battersea. And every life, Rosemary Dorset and the rest of the girls live a little while longer, not even knowing that their would-be killer is dead. Except for one life, when I didn't send a killer, and couldn't make the appointment myself, and Rosemary Dorset died, her body sliced up in the bathtub. I am now so used to killing Richard Lyle, it has acquired a rather ritualistic quality. I no longer bother with any fancy preparations, no words or hesitation. I merely go to his flat one day, settle down in a seat away from the window, wait for him to walk through the door, and put two through his brain. I have never felt that anything more is required. I wonder now if Vincent's attitude towards me was not entirely dissimilar to my regard for Lyle. Posing no threat, there was no need for him to return to me. But yet return he did, like a fond owner checking up on his favourite pet. As I kept Lyle perpetually in my sights, so he seemed to want to keep me close across the lives. Perhaps he considered my personality of such iron stuff that it might one day return to be a danger to him. Perhaps he feared I could regain my memory. Perhaps I was a victory prize, a trophy, proof of his success. Perhaps he simply wanted a friend whose very nature he could mould, life to life, to his needs. And how cooperative I had been, how helpful and malleable, from the very first to the very last. Perhaps it was all of these things in ever-changing measure. Whatever his motives, keep me close, Vincent did. By 1943, he was a captain, and I was surprised to receive a transfer to his very specialist unit of what my major termed boffins, bookworms, and other oily chaps. On arriving, I was less surprised to discover that Vincent Rankis had established himself as the go-to man for scientific know-how and expertise. "Why me?" I asked as he sat me down in his office. "Why did you request I join your unit? I'm a lawyer. I don't know anything about this science stuff." "Lieutenant," he replied, for I was still a humble subaltern, "you do yourself a disservice. When I met you in Scotland, you seemed one of the most capable men I've ever met. And if this army needs anything, it needs capable men." Indeed, I was of some use to the unit, for all its great scientific minds were clearly far too great to be bothered with such trivial details as whether there were enough blankets in the barracks, supplies for the canteen, and petrol coupons to get them to their meetings and back. "See, Harry," exclaimed Vincent, in our once monthly administrative roundup of business, "I told you you'd fit right in here." And so, while my old unit fought and died in the forests of France, I played secretary once again to Vincent Rankis and his rapidly growing private empire of brilliant minds. It was clear, politely yet obviously clear, that Vincent was already very rich, though the source of his wealth was not known among the men. However, as my role as administrative assistant grew, so did my access to information, including, eventually, the details of the account into which Vincent's pay was regularly deposited. Armed with this and an immaculate forgery of Vincent's signature, it was a simple enough matter to head down to the bank and request a complete history of Vincent's transactions. For the taxman, you know how it is. I was lucky. In my last life, my exhaustive research into Vincent's finances had revealed only a tangled web of offshore accounts and intricate security procedures, which had sent even the finest forensic accountants wheeling off around the world as they traced this piece of income to a sauna in Bangkok, or that to an Indian restaurant in Paris, or thought perhaps they'd found something in a line of credit which ended in the grocery department of Harrods. This time, with Vincent barely 19 years old, but doing a passable impression of 25, he hadn't had either the time or the opportunity to spread his finances far and wide, and a few bank details were enough for me to trace his finances back to the 1920s themselves. I had to fight to keep both my excitement and my activity secret. Living in such close proximity to Vincent, I knew I dared not keep any physical record of my activity in the base, so spent my time on leave in a small bed and breakfast in Hastings, poring over every line by light turned down low against the blackout curtain before burning every document I'd found and washing the ashes away. The pattern of his behaviour was in many ways predictable. Whenever he fell short, he gambled and, like all good Kalachakra, knew the victors of certain key races and bet heavily enough to ensure a good return, but widely enough to raise no questions in any one particular location as to how this boy could do so well. However, one detail did catch my eye. During the earliest years in which I could trace his movements, they seemed focused around the southwest of London, and, leaving aside the supplementary income provided by the races, he appeared to receive a regular income of £16 a month up to the start of the war. While there were plenty of innocent explanations for this, I could not help but suspect, could not but begin to believe, that what I was seeing was an allowance from a relative. Perhaps a very close relative indeed. It wasn't much, but it was a place to start looking. Quietly. So quietly. When VE Day came, I, in my capacity as the only one in Vincent's unit capable of organising a piss-up in a brewery, did exactly that, perhaps as a petty reminder to my peers that, for all they were brilliant, bright, intelligent, and quite possibly the future of scientific development, they were, nevertheless, incapable of running their own day-to-day lives without having someone to organise it for them. 2 weeks later, Vincent stuck his head round the door of my office. "Harry," he exclaimed, "I'm off out to meet a bird. Could you pop these in the post?" A great fistful of envelopes was given to me. I glanced at the addresses briefly. MIT, Harvard, Oxford, Cambridge, the Sorbonne. "No problem, sir." "For God's sake, Harry, surely we can stop using sir now." When he was gone, I steamed open one of the letters. Inside, written on thick yellow paper with no watermark, was a very detailed, very well-drawn diagram illustrating the uses, functionality and specifications of a microwave magnetron. I thought long and hard that night about what to do with these documents. They were dangerous, deadly, and postal distribution was precisely the same method as Vincent had deployed in his last life for kick-starting technological growth across the globe. Only this time, he wasn't limiting himself to ideas from 20 or 30 years in the future. Within those envelopes were ideas that wouldn't be expounded for at least 60 years. In the end, I went to Charity for advice. We met in Sheringham, a small town on the North Norfolk coast where the fish were always fresh, and you half imagined the catch had been blasted in across the shingle by the sheer force of the waves which pounded its shore. A salt-sprayed thundering that chafed the lips, dried the eyes and crystallised every hair within a few minutes of exposure to its roar. She was getting old, my ally, and would soon be looking at death. I was on the verge of being discharged from the army, still stuck in my uniform for a few more days, holding tightly onto my hat between my gloved fists as the wind howled in from a thick grey sky. "Well?" she demanded, as we strode first one way then the other along the few yards of beach that weren't foaming white. "What do you have for me now?" "Letters," I replied. "He's sending out letters again to all the universities and engineering institutions of the world. Not just America this time. Europe, Russia, China. Anywhere with resources and good minds. There's diagrams for Scud missiles, illustrations of wave-particle duality, analysis of heat-resistant orbital shields, analysis of weight-to-thrust ratios for orbital escape." She waved me to silence with one white-gloved hand.
"I think I see the problem, Harry."
"He's told me to post them."
"Are you going to?"
"I don't know. That's why I wanted to see you."
"I'm flattered that you value my opinion so highly."
She was waiting for me to talk it through, work it out for myself. So I did. "If I post these, history will change again, faster than ever before. I can't predict it, don't know what will happen, but these letters will revolutionise science, cut out 40 to 50 years of technological development. The clubs of the future.
The Cronus Club is already in turmoil, Harry. Last time Vincent did this, history itself was changed. Do not delude yourself into thinking it will be turned back by a few lifetimes."
"If I don't post them, my cover with Vincent will be blown. He'll realise that I can remember everything, and we'll be no closer to his point of origin."
"I still say we should just slice his ears off. It worked in the old days."
"He won't talk."
"You seem so sure of that, Harry."
"I didn't,
did I?
She pursed her lips, turned her head away from another great blast of spray across the shore.
I cannot make this choice for you. If you don't post the letters, then we'll have no choice but to pick Vincent up at once and attempt to interrogate the truth out of him. If you do post the letters, then, for this life at least, the world will once again dissolve into chaos. Order will crumble, the natural course of things will decline, and mankind will not be the same again. But
I will still have my position with Vincent, and still have a chance at tricking him into trusting me with his secrets.
Quite. I do not know this man. I have never met him, nor can I risk meeting him in case he knows who and what I am. I have no doubt that he's already perfecting the technology for the forgetting, just in case he should encounter more members of the Cronus Club. The choice is yours, Harry. Only you can judge the best way to end this.
You've been a great help, I grumbled.
She shrugged. This is your crusade, Harry, not mine. Do what you think fit. The Cronus Club? We can no longer judge. We have had our chance.
The following morning, I posted the letters and caught the first train out of town before I had a chance to change my mind.